Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Elizabeth Cassidy for the appellant, Mr. Benny Lee Hodge. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. The district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the FBI was improper. The district court had no basis for concluding that the FBI had fulfilled its obligations under FOIA. The district court never looked at the FBI's production to Mr. Hodge, never looked at the unredacted production in camera, and refused to examine what the FBI proffered as the July 2005 FOIA release to Mr. Hodge's co-defendant, Mr. Epperson. In addition, the district court impermissibly...
Are we all set now that the Epperson release was not a FOIA release?
While we can't say with certainty what was or was not released pursuant to FOIA, what we have learned subsequent to the district court proceedings is that there is evidence that it was that the 125-page report was not released pursuant to FOIA.
Right.
We can't say for certain. We're not entirely conceding that point, but that is what our additional investigation.
And that was a linchpin of the argument that there wasn't an adequate search was that 125-page report had been a FOIA release, right?
We focused on the 125-page report during the district court proceedings because it was the clearest example that the FBI had not fulfilled their obligations under FOIA.
Did you present any others?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. And even if it is true that the report was not released pursuant to FOIA, that's not dispositive of whether the FBI has fulfilled its burdens.
What other evidence did you offer?
Well, the record does not support that the FBI conducted an adequate search or has justified the applicability of its exemption.
Let's stick to the adequacy of the search at this first. Other than the 125-page report, what else did you identify to indicate that the search was inadequate?
Yes, Your Honor. And while the 125-page report...
Did you identify anything else?
We did point to the FBI's pattern of re-redacting material, its pattern of piecemeal productions, and the fact that it initially found, produced to Mr. Hodge 561, or only identified as responsive 561 pages, and then it was only after the filing of this litigation that it identified almost 1,000 more pages as being responsive to Mr. Hodge's
request. That happens a lot, unfortunately, and we'll ask the government about that, but it is the case when they go back, they'll sometimes find more documents, and that doesn't necessarily mean that the subsequent search combined with the initial search is inadequate. It means they've actually done a second round of due diligence and covered a broader group.
Yes, Your Honor. And while I think that we need to look at all the circumstances, it's not just that the FBI initially located only 561 responsive documents and then on a subsequent search located a larger universe, but the fact that within that larger universe, despite the fact that it has stated that it reviewed that information repeated times, it still identified 92 pages at the summary judgment stage when it was filing its motion of responsive pages that it had not yet found, and that was 6 months after, again, telling Mr. Hodge that it had concluded processing his FOIA request.
We have previously observed that if we concluded in a particular case that an agency's sequential finding of more and more material was an indication of inadequate search, we would create a disincentive to the agency doing a continuing search.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the case the FBI relies on is Mirpol, and I think that there's a distinction between the facts here and those in Mirpol, in which the court found that the subsequent productions did in fact support that an adequate search had been made, and noted that there would be created a disincentive for the agency to go back and produce responsive material. But here, in Mirpol, the requester pointed to specific files that had not been searched, in the responsive documents that it had been produced. It then pointed to additional places that may not have been searched. And the agency, in the spirit of cooperation, went back and re-reviewed those files and continued to produce responsive material. And in that situation, it wasn't indicative that the search was inadequate and indicated that the agency was working with the requester to find the information. Here, the same documents have been reviewed several times. And each time they're reviewed, the same universe of documents, there's additional information that's released to Mr. Hodge.
Don't you think these Hardy declarations, if you read through these, they describe a fairly extensive, thorough process of looking for material, and Mr. Hardy details how they do it and
Yes,
I don't know why. I'm not sure. It's tough for us where we are to say, after reading all of that, it's inadequate.
Right, and Mr. Hardy does detail the places that were looked, and he does give a detail of the search that was undertaken. But I think what the Hardy Declaration fails to explain is some of the gaps in the record, which is, why were there additional documents found after the initial request? Why has there been a need to re-redact? Not that there necessarily may be a bad faith in doing so, but an explanation. And that's what the Hardy Declaration doesn't provide.
But we said, have we not, that there's a presumption that the agency has made a search in good faith. And the cases that I'm familiar with, but you may know of others, where a plaintiff has said, you fail to look at a certain series of documents, all right, as distinct from what Judge Kavanaugh and you were discussing is the concern about the disincentive for the agency having made a decision never to do anything. I mean, it delays your getting the documents, but the theory is you get them and the court doesn't have to order the agency to produce them. Let me ask you to go on to your segregability argument.
Yes, Your Honor. We, at the time of the district court proceedings, the 125-page report was evidence that segregable material had not been released. And while the additional facts we learned subsequent to the district court proceedings suggest that it was not, in fact, released pursuant to FOIA, again, we don't know with certainty, the additional facts we've learned also suggest that there is still information in the public domain that has not been released to Mr. Hodge. And on remand, we think it's more appropriate for the district court to look at all of the evidence that it should have looked at the time to determine whether or not there is information that was released to Mr. Epperson that is still being withheld from Mr. Hardy. But I do think that the larger issue here, Your Honor, is that based on the record below, the FBI also has not justified the applicability of Exemption 7D. The majority of documents that Mr. Hartz has received.
This is a triple murder case, and there are people contacted who have witnesses or have information about a very violent crime, and the FBI represents, I think that it would be a disaster for names to be disclosed here. Some of them have expressed assurances of confidentiality as listed by the privacy or keep private, keep confidential label in the file. Others implied assurances because of the nature of the people. I mean, that's a big risk, isn't it? Those people's safety to put their names out, given the nature of the crime, which the Supreme Court's talked about, is a very important factor here.
It is, Your Honor, but the burden is on the FBI to prove the applicability of the exemptions it claimed. And our argument...
The ones that are most in contention are ones where the FBI marked on the file to confidential.
Yeah, I think what we're more focused on is the implied grants of confidentiality, because that applied...
In other words, you'll concede if there's a document that says confidential, that's enough.
We also do think that...
And Hardy has declared that a number of those documents did have that. Some documents actually have statements from the witness indicating they wish confidentiality. Others just have a stamp on it saying confidential.
Right. What the Hardy Declaration claims is that the words protect or protect identity appear on the documents with regard to certain sources.
Right.
And we, while we're not as concerned about the information withheld under express grants, we do think that something more was needed rather than just Mr. Hardy saying in a declaration that the words appeared on the face of the documents.
Wouldn't witnesses in this kind of triple murder case, isn't that a big factor in them wanting their identities not to be disclosed? I think that's just common sense, and the Supreme Court's recognized that common sense in Landano, I think.
Yes, and it is a concern, Your Honor, but the solution is not just to uphold the agency's conclusory assertion. The solution, as this court recognized, has recognized in Roth and in Campbell and undertaken this analysis, is the solution when revealing the information would tend to reveal exactly what the agency is trying to disclose. The solution is for the district court to conduct an in-camera review. Here it would have been very easy for the district court.
We've never required that. I realize that makes this an odd, FOIA is an odd structure litigation-wise in many ways, but we've never required that kind of in-camera review.
Right. Yeah. Well, and while the in-camera review is not required, there are circumstances where it's warranted. And our position here is that the circumstances warranted an in-camera review because the agency affidavit wasn't insufficient. But I'd like to talk a bit more about the implied grants of confidentiality because, again, 750 pages of the production to Mr. Hodge were withheld or redacted based on implied grants. And Landano does require a particularized description of the nature of the crime and the witness's relation to it. The Hardy Declaration does not give the sufficient particularized description. It only states that third-party sources provided specific detailed information that is singular in nature concerning the criminal activities involving plaintiff, his associates, and or other subjects of this investigation, and then says that the crimes were of a violent nature. In Roth, this court recognized...
Well, let's just stop there. Isn't that, you know, if you're a witness to a triple murder case and you're providing information to the FBI, I doubt you want your name out.
Well, I think that that goes too far, Your Honor. I think that while with the witnesses have an interest in their identity, there's a lot of different techniques that the FBI uses to obtain information during FOIA, and it's not the Supreme Court in Landano rejected that there's a presumption of confidentiality over all of confidential sources, and that's why Landano requires that particularized description. And
let me ask a question. Does the amount of information or evidence necessary to satisfy the FBI's burden, is that affected at all by the nature of the crime?
It is affected by the nature of the crime. That is one...
In other words, Judge Kavanaugh is suggesting in a triple murder case, perhaps less would be required from the FBI to show that might be true in a bank robbery case.
Yes, sir, and I think that that goes to more what the court was addressing in Mays versus DEA. And the court has recognized that in some circumstances, the crime can be so violent and there's such a fear of retaliation and reprisal. But it's not actually that it's a violent crime. It's the threat of retaliation or reprisal. In Mays, the crime actually was not a violent crime, but a drug conspiracy. And the court
in a triple murder, though, and Landano ends, as you know, the very last paragraph after rejecting the presumption, Justice O'Connor's opinion, more narrowly defined circumstances, however, can provide a basis for inferring confidentiality. For example, when circumstances such as the nature of the crime investigated and the witness's relation to it supports an inference, the government is entitled to a presumption. And if there's any crime that you think would fit the bill of what Justice O'Connor's opinion was contemplating, would think it would be a crime like this case.
I thought your argument was more addressed to the last part of that phrase.
It is, Your Honor, and it does go to more the threat of retaliation or reprisal. What
no,
that
the,
suggests is that the source's relation to the crime. And the second point, though, about the retaliation or reprisal, it's I don't think what they were getting at in Landano, and in Mays, the court actually was careful not to assume a blanket presumption over all drug crimes. In Mays, the court said it was specifically attaching the implied confidentiality only in cases involving a drug conspiracy to distribute cocaine because of the documented threat of violence and retaliation attendant to those circumstances.
All right,
that
so
evidence just hasn't been presented here.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The hypothetical would be that there are some witnesses who were eyewitnesses to these grisly murders, but that there are other witnesses who provided information to the FBI, but it may simply have been, yes, this is the man who lives next to me at such and such an address. So they are witnesses, but they are not witnesses where arguably it's self-evident that they would have a reasonable apprehension of retaliation. And therefore, the FBI has to say specifically that even though this witness was not an eyewitness, but simply a neighbor, we are of the view that he too is in a position where his confidentiality must be preserved because of possible retaliation. In other words, that's, I thought, the gist of your argument.
Yes, the gist of our argument is that you cannot just presume confidentiality over all of the sources just because it happens to be a violent crime. You have to point to the particularized circumstances or offer an explanation for why this is comparable to a conspiracy to distribute cocaine or a gang-related murder or crimes related to organized crime, which the FBI, they've offered no evidence and made that nexus between why a particularized description isn't required based on the circumstances here.
Can I ask you a quick 7C question, which is what's the interest that you're asserting on the public interest side of the balance here, and how will the documents connect up to that interest?
Yes, and with regard to 7C, our argument is really that the district court's error was in recognizing no public interest at all. The district court just stated that there was no public interest, and therefore that 7C applied. And what we're getting at is that the district court, that the balance may or may not tip in Mr. Hodge's favor, the district court is not excused from recognizing that there is a public interest in government misconduct and conducting the required analysis to see whether the facts of this case meet that burden. We think it was error for the district court to recognize no public interest at all.
What's your theory of how the documents that you're seeking connect up to the public interest that you're asserting?
We think that as the Comp Declaration makes clear, this case has been replete with government misconduct throughout Mr. Hodge's criminal proceedings, which the details of which I'm not specifically familiar with, but that the documents are so heavily redacted here that we don't even know what information could be applied.
So government, is this a theory of you trying to get evidence that would exonerate him?
We noted that there's a recognized public interest in getting information, but we don't, based on the fact that the documents are so heavily redacted pursuant to Exemption 7D, we don't even have the resources or
You don't know.
We don't know. We don't know what the information is, and that's characteristic.
So that's your segregability argument, as I understand it.
That's also
why I was asking you about it. There's no way for this court to tell whether or not the releasable information is not also redacted.
Yes, Your Honor.
And somebody has to look at the records to figure that out.
Yes, Your Honor, and the records nothing's been placed on the record that would allow you to conduct that analysis. I see my time's up.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jeremy Simon for the FBI and the Department of Justice. This is a FOIA case in which a criminal defendant seeks investigative-related information about himself. I would like to just address the following areas of my argument. The search, Exemption 7D, Exemption 7C, and then if there are any questions from the court as to the issue of waiver, I'd be happy to discuss that as well.
I need to talk about segregability.
Well, Your Honor, the FBI has met its burden of establishing that it used efforts to reasonably segregate all non-exempt information.
And how did it do that?
I did that in the Hardy Declaration, where he described their efforts to segregate.
Yes. And my question is, how can anyone know whether or not there was over-redaction unless somebody's looked at the records?
Well, Your Honor, a requirement of that effect would be essentially requiring in-camera review, which this court does not require the district court to undertake.
In all circumstances. But if the judge is going to make a finding that the documents were reasonably redacted, how can he make it if he hasn't looked at the documents?
Well, case law requires is that the FBI's affidavits establish or make a showing that the FBI has engaged in a segregability effort.
So here what we have is we have Mr. Hardy with some very long footnotes. And if you were to, unlike a Vaughan index, where you can identify what the exemption is, what paragraph it's dealing with, et cetera, here there's just a list, and the documents aren't before us. There's no way for us to know. Maybe they just redacted the whole page when, in fact, there is information that doesn't fall with any of these exemptions. That's all I'm getting at. I mean, just as a practical matter, how do you do that as a district court judge?
Well, I think that the Hodge has an obligation to provide to the district court evidence that he believes contradicts the assertions in the
argument. How can you get that evidence, though, to follow up on Judge Rogers' question? Again, this is an oddity of FOIA litigation, but if you think the redactions look like too much, how are you supposed to, and the district court hasn't looked at the documents, it's just trust us.
Well, it's more than that, Your Honor, because Hodge acknowledges in his own submissions that as these additional releases occurred, more and more information was provided to Hodge. In other words,
That cuts both ways.
Yes.
Yeah, it makes it seem like it was the lawsuit that prompted more, and that the initial review was not good enough.
Well,
and that doesn't give us great confidence necessarily in how the initial reviews of FOIA cases are done.
Well, but the fact is, when the record before the district court was the record as the releases stood at the time of those filings. And at that time, the FBI had made multiple productions of the same documents with more information provided, demonstrating the effort to segregate exempt from non-exempt information and corroborating what the Hardy Declaration stated on that regard. And Hodge did nothing to contradict. To the opposite extreme, they actually corroborated the statements in the Hardy Declaration by acknowledging that more information was provided. There were less redactions in the subsequent
releases. Again, on the contradict point, I just think we can say that and pretend that there's a real ability to contradict, but
I'd also like to point out,
it's just trusting the FBI person and who does the affidavit that they're not doing it incorrectly.
Well, Your Honor, the affidavit is entitled to a presumption of good faith unless there's contradictory evidence in the record. And I would also say...
No, and I'm just wondering how you would get that evidence. Yeah, obviously some cases, a whistleblower or something comes up that looks inconsistent on the face of the affidavit. But otherwise, it's just a leap of faith, right? Because if the district court doesn't do it in camera. I realize this is where the jurisprudence is. I'm just saying it's analytically quite odd.
Leap of faith. I mean, there's the process. The FBI has a FOIA process and has FOIA professionals that go through these processes.
I understand that, but from a judge's perspective, usually you don't say, if someone just says that's good enough, we're not going to independently review it. We've adopted the rule in the FOIA context, and you've said, it can be contradicted. I'm just pointing out that's...
Well, I would also
comfort in many cases.
I would also make the point that that Hodge below did not ask the district court to conduct an in-camera review, and so you cannot fault the district court for not doing so when Hodge at that time did not make that request.
So
that's really a very important point. At no point did Hodge request an in-camera review.
My review of their briefs below did not reveal that they had done so, and the court does not indicate that in its decision.
I was just trying to check the briefs. I don't see that anybody cited our decision in Stoltz Nielsen Transport Group versus United States 534 Fed 3rd 728 DC Circuit 2008. There, the declaration said, in terms of this segregability, the government's justified it by saying that a paralegal, quote, had reviewed each page line by line to assure himself that he was withholding from disclosure only information exempt pursuant to the Act. This court said that's insufficient, and we remanded for the district court to make some findings.
I believe in the Harris case versus DOJ that we cited in our brief, that the court found similar language to be satisfactory in an affidavit. In other words, that...
Petitioner cites it. Petitioner cites that case in its opening brief.
So you think our authority is contradictory?
And you don't respond.
Well, Your Honor, we do cite Jerez in the segregability section, and I believe Jerez does say that a affidavit describing the efforts to segregate is sufficient, and it describing that the documents were reviewed, reasonable efforts were made to provide non-exempt information and the like, And I'd also note that many of the documents in which these redactions were made are witness interview type documents. So it's not surprising that you may see substantial redactions on these documents based on the Exemption 7D, which leads me to that issue. Under Exemption 7D, the FBI is entitled to withhold information provided by confidential sources and also the identity of the confidential sources. And here we have a situation, as Judge Kavanaugh recognized, where these are multiple homicides. And it is a criminal enterprise. This is just not a one situation where there is one murder. This is a criminal enterprise where there is an interstate transportation of stolen money, multiple accomplices, brutal murders in, I believe, the states of Kentucky and I believe even in Florida, strangulation, beatings, impersonating an FBI officer to enter a residence.
If it's a grisly crime,
yes.
There is no obligation to look at the records to be certain that only material that falls within the exemption has been redacted. Is that the rule you're asking the court to adopt? Well,
actually, Your Honor, I was talking about the grisly nature of the crime coupled with the Mr. Hardy's statement that it was specific detailed information that was provided by these witnesses, singular in nature, that actually led to the prosecution and conviction of these individuals. All of that together, and that there is a potential for reprisal given the nature of the crime, all of that together justifies the withholding under the implied assurance of confidentiality rationale.
Hardy's affidavit indicates that every one of the witnesses who are being treated as confidential provided evidence that was directly used in the prosecution or indirectly used in the prosecution.
That's correct, and that's what distinguishes this case from the hypothetical Judge Rogers gave at the end of appellant's argument. These are not just a next-door neighbor. Was Mr. Hodges' car parked in his driveway at this hour? These are people who gave evidence of a singular nature. So the revealing of that information would tie that back to the source. And the FBI is entitled to protect that information. And the case law encourages and allows the FBI to do so in order to encourage people to come forward. On the issue of Exemption 7C, Hodge did not make a favish showing regarding any misconduct by federal actors. And therefore, it was proper for the district court not to engage in any balancing.
In this case, the FBI worked with the state prosecutors.
There's nothing in the record in this case. That was in the Roth case. That was a connection that the court recognized. In this case, there's nothing in the record to indicate that the FBI was involved in the investigation to some extent, but not the prosecution.
Well, okay.
And in Roth,
there was the investigation, the prosecution relies on the investigation. I mean, these are hand-in-glove situations.
Well, in Roth, the assistant...
No, I understand.
Okay.
But I'm talking about this case.
Well, the other distinguishing feature here, Your Honor, is that in Roth, there was actually a finding that the FBI had previously withheld potentially exculpatory information, and there also was an affidavit submitted that... put the blame of the murders in that case on the three individuals whose privacy interests were implicated in connection with the Exemption 7C claim. Here, there's been no showing by Hodge of any misconduct by any federal actor. All of their evidence of misconduct pertains to the state actors in the state prosecution. There is no showing that the FBI had any prior situation where it was found in this matter to have withheld potentially exculpatory information. And they're not suggesting that someone else, that there's another individual whose name may appear in the FBI records who actually did the crime. There's no concrete showing of that as there was in Roth. So therefore, they have not met the favish showing. And if you, in the district court, this issue of public interest and government misconduct really only appeared in the Hodges reply memorandum. They didn't address this in their opening brief to the district court. And so for that additional reason, the district court was entitled not to consider that.
What do you think about the argument? Do you think there is public interest here within the meaning of FOIA?
I don't believe they've made that showing, Your Honor. I think what we have here is speculation as and bare suspicions not sufficient to meet the demanding FAVIS showing. If the court doesn't have any other questions on Exemption 7C, I'd just briefly like to talk about the waiver point. I understand Hodge's position to be that they are largely not contesting anymore the notion that this 125-page submission of unredacted pages was the enclosure to this July 2005 FOIA release letter. I think that largely dispenses of that issue.
Can I just be clear, though, on one thing?
Yes.
The 125-page report was, is it clear from the record whether or not it was in the FBI files?
Well, the Hardy Declaration states that the FBI did a page-by-page review of the release as it existed in its database, and that portions of that 125-page submission were in the 450-page FOIA release, but they were in that 450-page FOIA release with redactions consistent with the exemptions referenced on the cover letter.
So the answer to my question is yes?
Well, not the answer to the question is in part yes. I mean, not the entire 125-page report. And recognizing, Your Honor, that...
So whose report was it?
Yes, that's a good question. Where did this 125-page report come from?
I thought it was an FBI investigative report.
It is an FBI investigative report, and the record would suggest, although it's not conclusive, that this was a Brady material provided. Remember, this is the Epperson release. This is not the Hodge.
My question only goes to the adequacy of the search. If Mr. Hodge says, I want all documents where my name appears, and we know that an FBI investigative report had his name in it, and yet he's making the argument that, you know, it wasn't released to him, or at least not released in the same way, because he said a co-defendant had it, and therefore, since it's out in the public domain, you know, any exemption sort of waived. And your argument is just because it's out there doesn't mean you can't raise exemptions later.
I misunderstood the court's question previously. I thought the court was asking, was this 125-page report part of the FOIA release to Epperson? If the court's question is, was that 125-page report part of the release to Hodge, the answer is that Hodge has identified only 5 pages, JA 511 to 516 of the record, that they contend was a document with Hodge's name on it within that 125-page document that was not part of the release to Hodge. And our position is that to the extent the FBI failed to locate 1 5-page document, this court's precedent says that that does not call into question the integrity of the search.
The adequacy of the search. Yeah. All right.
The court does not have any further questions.
Let me ask you a question. Why is, given present computer technology, why is it difficult to make a complete search? I'm puzzled.
Well, here, Your Honor, this Hodge's name appears in what they call multi-subject files. And you can look at some of the documents that are in the under seal portion of the record, and you can see that in the one document that Hodge identifies, that there are multiple names listed on these records. And so what happens is FBI will do a search of the multi-file database, and we'll then have to go through and they'll have a universe of potentially responsive documents. Then they need to manually go through and see whether, in fact, the person's name actually appears on those documents. And remember that...
Wait a minute. You've already identified all the documents where his name appears. That's done by computer, right? And that's rather easy. You collect them all, and they're there. Now, what's the problem?
I don't know that it's. I don't believe it's the initial part is identifying their name. It's, for instance, in this case, the search for potentially responsive documents would pick up other investigative materials related to these murders. Okay, but those documents may not have Hodge's name on them. And the FOIA request asked for documents that reference Hodge. So, for instance, some of these Epperson documents relate to the same murder, but they will not.
Wait. The request asked for documents that reference Hodge. Why can't your computer in 10 minutes come up with every document that mentions Hodge?
That's not how the documents, as I understand, are indexed. I think they're indexed not necessarily.
You don't have a computer system that just you plug in the name and it'll tell you every document that uses that name?
I don't believe they have that. I don't believe that's how they conduct a search, Aaron. I believe that there are indices, and the indices may or may not have documents with the individual's name, which is why the FBI had to go and search through 6,000 pages of 5,000 or 6,000 pages of essentially responsive documents.
So these investigative reports and other documents are not on the computer. They're not, what's the word, lasered onto the computer. What is it when we do, you know, so you could pick it up?
Google.
No, it's not Google, but in other words, they're not entered into the digital system that the computer searches, all right? Rather, this is a question. Is that what you're saying?
Well, my understanding is what's in the record in this case.
Well, I'm looking at Mr. Hardy's declaration. He says how they did this, and he doesn't answer Judge Silverman's question. That's all I'm getting at.
Well, I don't know that for the purposes of the FOIA affidavit, exactly the nature in which these names are stored, sort of the computer systems, are entirely germane to how they conduct to the information that Mr. Hardy was presenting. What he was describing was the search methodology and explaining why it was that there would be 5,000 or 6,000 pages of potentially responsive documents that would then need to be reviewed manually to identify the actual documents that pertain to Mr.
Hodge. Judge Silverman's point is that it should be a lot easier than it sounds, and maybe that's a technology issue at the FBI. But
yes, Your Honor, I don't believe I can comment on where the FBI stands in upgrading its technology.
You'll see, paragraph 27 of the first Hardy affidavit doesn't help us. It says exactly what you said. You know, the files are filed by indices. Is counsel at the co-counsel at the table from the FBI?
No. Craig is not. Craig we can't blame him for the FBI completely.
I wasn't going to blame him. I just thought he might have information.
I would like just to come back to what Hodge has attempted to show with respect to the search. They've not challenged the search methodology. The only challenge they've made is to this 15-page document that they say was part of this 125-page document, and they say that references Hodge, and it wasn't part of the release to Hodge, out of 1,700 or so documents that were processed. And under this court's case law, that is just not sufficient to call into question the adequacy of the search.
Anything else you'd like to say?
That's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Thank you, Your Honor. And there's 3 points we'd like to raise on rebuttal. The first being that a comparison of the production to Mr. Hodge with a comparison of the 450-page release we learned of after the district court proceedings does show that exemptions are being applied inconsistently. Exemption 7D has been applied to the production that was made to Mr. Hodge, and it's not even been invoked in the production to Mr. Epperson, which seriously undermines both the FBI's argument that there should be an implied grant of confidentiality in all of the circumstances.
Is that from the 125-page report to Epperson?
No, this is from the 455 pages we learned of after. And also it supports what Judge Rogers' point about segregability. It supports that all segregable information hasn't been released. And we are prepared on remand to offer that evidence to the district court to make its factual determination.
Did you ask the district court to examine the records in camera?
We asked the district court to conduct discovery into both the Hardy Declaration and into whether exemptions were being properly applied.
You did not ask for in camera.
Not specifically for in-camera review, but
what, what did you mean by you asked the district court for discovery? That was to allow you. Is that not right? Is it distinct from the district court itself?
Yes, Your Honor, and we did ask for discovery into also whether we could learn more information about whether the exemptions were being properly applied. We didn't specifically ask for in-camera review, but again, at that time, we saw the 125-page report as being evidence that we could offer that showed in-camera review wasn't necessary because this was such clear evidence. In addition, the...
So as the FBI continued to release more documents, at any point did you ask the district court to... review the documents in camera?
Not specifically in camera, Your Honor. I don't believe. We,
as I recall the record, at one point the prosecutor proffered to the district court that the records were available if the district court wanted them.
Yes, the FBI has offered the records to the district court. It was the district court that refused to examine the records. And I would like to make one other point regarding the adequacy of the search in the five pages. It's our position that it's more likely than not that these five pages, regardless of whether they were released pursuant to FOIA to another requester, are in the FBI's files, referred to Mr. Hodge by name, and haven't been located, because it's not just the five pages, but there was 40 additional pages that had been produced to Mr. Hodge but redacted from the 125 pages. So the fact that they've produced some of these pages in the report already to Mr. Hodge, pursuant to his request, indicates that these other five pages, which are part of the report, what it's more likely than not that they're also in the file. And one more point about your argument, your question about segregability. We presented Exhibit M of the Koyama Declaration, which begins at the Joint Appendix, page 390, as an example of redactions being excessively applied and segregable information not being released. And despite that, the district court found that the non-exempt information provided some guidance as to whether the exemptions were being improperly invoked. But if you actually look at Exhibit M, there's very little non-exempt information. Virtually all the pages of Exhibit M are redacted, so it's difficult to see how the district court could have reached that conclusion without...
Well, counsel suggested a lot of these pages are witness interviews.
Yes, it is our understanding that a lot of them are witness interviews, but again, if you look at what was produced to Mr. Epperson in the 450 pages, there have been an inconsistent application of both the exemptions and the redactions within the documents. If Your Honors have no further questions.
No, thank you. Well, I don't.
No. Thank you very much for your time.
We'll take the case under advisement. Thank you.